This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. The last 2 weeks, I've read the introduction to the new book, Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of the Planet by Ben Goldfarb. Ben is the author of Eager, The Surprising Secret Lives of Beavers and Why They Matter. I've read from Eager 3 times, and you can access all of my past readings by going to the WDRT.org archives and looking at the podcasts. Ben Goldfarb is one of my favorite authors and doesn't disappoint with this new book. He's taken a difficult and huge topic and delved into the not-so-obvious aspects of how our highways impact the world we and our fellow creatures live in. Today I'm jumping ahead to Chapter 7, ahead of fascinating stories and revealing tales of the migrating herds of mule deer and pronghorn antelope in Wyoming and Colorado, and how they've lived for centuries, knowing the routes through generations of accumulated knowledge and shared culture, timing their movements to correspond with the northward movement of the greening, fresh, succulent vegetation as spring moves north. It has only been understood recently just how the east-west blocking highways are impacting these animals. And I'm jumping ahead of his writing about the effects of road noise and of the many ways the roadsides are managed, some a monoculture of grass and only grass, or sometimes they are more diverse with multiple kinds of plants. Some are sown with prairie plants and milkweed. How I wish I had time to read all this to you. I hope you will get this book for yourself or borrow it from the library. Today I find myself at Chapter 7, called Life on the Verge. Will the highway's novel ecosystem save America's most beloved butterfly or obliterate it? Perhaps you may be as surprised as I am to hear what he has to say about positive effects a highway running in the right direction can have on a species. Chapter 7. Imagine for a moment this scenario. You're cruising a 2-lane Midwestern highway at the end of a long day, corn rippling out the driver's side window, westering sun in your eyes, when you realize with a start that your windshield is clean. In your youth, you recall, this same trip left your car as battered as a Pollock canvas, smeared with the debris of grasshoppers and beetles and spiders ballooning on silken threads, the infinitesimal casualties that Barry Lopez called aerial plankton. Perhaps, like Lopez, you'd scrubbed at your grill, ashamed of the damn spots that implicated you in mass murder. Quote, "I am uneasy carrying so many of the dead," Lopez mourned. "The carnage is so obvious." Today, however, your conscience is as immaculate as your windshield, unmarred by so much as a flying ant. With growing unease, you wonder, what gives? In fact, your observation has a name, the windshield phenomenon. Its innocuous moniker belies the horror it describes. We are living through what some entomologists have called an insect apocalypse, an invertebrate die-off that's all the scarier for being so poorly understood. According to one analysis, insects are going extinct 8 times faster than mammals, reptiles, and birds. Per the same study, the world loses 2.5% of its insect mass every year. The apocalypse is both exacerbated by roads — cars kill billions of North American pollinators every year — and revealed by them. Like mobile natural history museums, windshields once showcased the exuberance of the invertebrate world, its blizzards of moths and midges. Now our cars remain spotless, and gas station squeegees sit useless in their soapy buckets. Some scientists argue that the windshield phenomenon is an illusion created by modern cars, along whose streamlined bodies insects tumble rather than splat. Then again, as one entomologist told Science, "I drive a Land Rover with the aerodynamics of a refrigerator, and these days it stays clean." Like most animal collapses, the insect apocalypse starts with habitat loss. That's particularly true in the Midwest, where more than 99% of historic tall grass prairie has been sacrificed to agriculture and development. As usual, infrastructure spurred the devastation. The railroads that gashed the Great Plains in the 19th century also opened this inland sea to farmers, who promptly plowed up the milkweeds, indigos, paintbrushes, and larkspurs that nurtured insect life. The remaining original tall grass in Illinois, known anachronistically as the Prairie State, could today scarcely cover a half a dozen corn farms. Yet a funny thing happened en route to the prairie's liquidation. Transportation, the handmaiden of its destruction, became its refuge. As row crops overwhelmed the Midwest, the only safe spaces were the rights of way that bordered roads and train tracks, the exclusive property of government and private railroads. Precarious strips of native plants, tickseed and anemone, switchgrass and beargrass, thimbleweed and snakeroot, and bluebell and snow on the mountain, clung to the highway sides like stubble on an unshaved cheek, offering succor to six-legged refugees. In Michigan, Amtrak's lines sustain bluestem, rosinweed, and compass plant among the last prairie relics in the state. In Wisconsin, endangered Karner blue butterflies dip their proboscises into lupin that lined sandy roads on military bases. Roadsides were eclectic and cosmopolitan habitats, dive bars where pre-colonial prairie plants like lady's slipper rubbed elbows with gritty, sun-loving foreigners like dandelion. Above all, roadsides were novel ecosystems, amalgams of nature and technology that were created by Homo sapiens, but had become largely self-governed, anthropocentric environments that resembled nothing so much as themselves. I toured Minnesota's roadside ecosystem one July on a county highway in the St. Paul outskirts, its drainage ditch abloom with oxeye daisy, bee balm, trefoil, and milkweed. It was one of those swampy summer mornings when the whole Midwest feels like a damp armpit. Five students in yellow vests, members of a University of Minnesota research group called Team Ditch, flogged the black-eyed Susans and Queen Anne's lace with butterfly nets. Around us, sterile lawns dominated the St. Paul sprawl. Beyond the city, corn and soy fields stretched to the horizon. Roadsides offered sanctuary from these monocultures. Floral confetti splashed against suburbia's muted green. One student waved her net to capture a cobalt butterfly smaller than a pinky nail. Another scooped up bumblebees pantalooned with pollen. A third scythed the flowers and dumped her squirming harvest into a plastic bag, garden spiders, katydids, and parasitoid wasps. This is a whole community that we drive past without even noticing, Tim Mitchell marveled. For all its unlikely benefits, though, the road is still the road, noisy, chemical-laced, perilous, an environment that both nourishes insects and reduces them to goo. As Team Ditch thrashed the flowers, a monarch butterfly sailed into view. She, for she was a she, identifiable by the thick black veins in her orange wings, flew in languid zigzags, seeking a place to lay an egg. There was something of the flaneuse about her, the window shopper drifting between storefronts. We bit our lips as she sailed into traffic. She tumbled like a cork bobber in a rapid, buffeted by turbulence. At last, she alit on a milkweed, touched her thorax to its surface, and freckled it with a white speck. We cheered. Egg deposited, the butterfly took off again, bound for a stand of milkweed across the road. She just bounced over three cars, kind of impressive, Emily Snell-Rude said. I'm so worried for her. At least she's already replaced herself, Tim Mitchell said. except larval mortality by predation is at least 95%, Snell Rood replied. In other words, for every 20 eggs she laid, 19 of her caterpillars would be devoured by wasps, spiders, and other foes. Mitchell shrugged. Maybe she's already laid 100. We watched the monarch wobble. Every moment I expected to see her hit a windshield, but buoyed by her wings or slipstreams or good fortune, she waved it over traffic and gained the shoulder. There in the quiet eddy of the ditch, she settled onto a milkweed and laid another egg. As with all life cycles, it's hard to know where the monarch butterflies begins. Circles, unlike roads, lack origins. But start here. August in North America, when shorter days and cooler nights spur monarchs into action. All summer long, butterflies, hundreds of millions of them, have drifted over the continent, New York and New Brunswick, North Dakota and North Carolina, Maine and Minnesota, depositing eggs on milkweed and slurping nectar from coneflowers and goldenrod. Now, summer is ending and monarchs head south. They fly during the day when the sun warms their scaled wings. They feed so often they gain weight as they travel. In September, the monarchs converge. Streams of butterflies meet in Texas, cross the border, and climb into Mexico's mountains, a rare river that flows uphill. They ascend passes and course up canyons, their flocks thickening as the air thins. Cops in Nuevo León slow traffic to let them pass. At last, 10,000 feet above sea level, they settle in a patchy fir forest and huddle together to spend winter in an energy-saving torpor. When the writer Sue Halpern visited their roost, she found them, quote, so heavy on the branches of the pine trees that the branches bent toward the ground, supplicants to gravity and mass and sheer enthusiasm, unquote. Most migratory animals have straightforward commutes. The same deer who start into Wyoming's mountains each spring, for instance, ramble back to their winter valleys in November. Monarchs scoff at such simple journeys. In March, the butterflies who overwintered in Mexico fly north again, tattered and nearly transparent with age. They make it as far as Texas, lay eggs, and die. Their offspring fly north, spread out, and begin to repopulate the continent. After a few weeks, they too breed and die. A couple more rounds of this ensue. Breed and die, until late summer, when the last crop of butterflies embarks on its own trip to Mexico's mountains. This means, incredibly, that no individual monarch experiences the species' entire life cycle. The butterfly I saw dancing through traffic in Minnesota was likely third generation. Her grandparents had gone to Mexico, and her offspring would as well, but she would never lay her compound eyes on Monarch Valhalla herself. I found something poignant in that. This poor parochial butterfly, churning out caterpillars in her corner of the Midwest, her existence brief and utilitarian, living in service to her glamorous, adventurous children. And that's where I'll stop reading Ben Goldfarb right now. I will continue next week with more on the migration of the monarch butterflies and Interstate Highway 35 that runs from Duluth to Laredo, Texas, north-south through the United States. I'm reading from Ben Goldfarb's new book, Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. This is Maggie Jones. Thank you for listening.